Books of Enoch. We'd like to talk a little bit about the various versions of the Books of Enoch that are now available to the scholarly world and how they might relate a little bit to the Prophet Joseph Smith. In the summer of 1830, the Prophet Joseph Smith received a revelation. And then in December of that same year, he was provided with insights into the life and activities of Enoch. It came as a bonus because of the faithfulness of the branch of the Colesville Saints, where the Prophet Joseph Smith himself had been a missionary. He was probably one of the first missionaries of the church. And the Colesville Saints, because of their endurance and the things that happened during the summer of 1830, received as a bonus extracts from the Book of Enoch. Today, beginning with about chapter 6 of the Purgate Price, as the Purgate Price in the Book of Moses, those revelations were given to the Prophet Joseph Smith in 1830 concerning Enoch. Then in the Doctrine and Covenants, in section 107, there's a statement concerning the writings of Enoch. In 107, it tells about the episode 3 years before the death of Adam. He called his sons together, had a great meeting at Adam on the Ammon. The Lord appeared to them. They rose up and blessed Adam, called him Michael, the prince, the archangel. And the Lord administered comfort unto Adam. Adam stood up in the midst of the congregation, and notwithstanding he was bowed down with age, being full of the Holy Ghost, predicted whatsoever should befall his posterity until the last generation. Then it says in verse 57, these things were all written in the Book of Enoch, and are to be testified of in due time. So the Doctrine and Covenants tells us we can expect in due time, when it's prudent, wise in the eyes of Jesus Christ, we'll be given the contents of the Book of Enoch. Elsewhere, also in Genesis and in Jude, we find references to the Book of Enoch. In fact, in the New Testament, there are 127 references to the Book of Enoch. Why, then, is it not part of the canon of the New Testament today? Something happened in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century that eliminated the Book of Enoch from the Christian canon. And likewise from the Old Testament canon. In the year 1773, after a period of almost total obscurity lasting 1,500 years, the Scottish explorer James Bruce discovered in what is now Ethiopia the Book of Enoch. Now, he was quite an explorer. These and other books were discovered by him as he traveled through North Africa, Egypt, and elsewhere. He actually found these in a tomb associated with some bodies. He writes, amongst the articles I consigned to the library at Paris was a very beautiful and magnificent copy of the prophecies of Enoch. Another is among the books of Scripture which I brought home, standing immediately before the Book of Job, which is its proper place in the Abyssinian canon. He's telling us here that one of the magnificent copies that he brought back was a canon of the Abyssinian church. It contained, before the Book of Job, the Book of Enoch. And he says, in a third copy I presented to the Bodleian Library at Oxford by the hand of Dr. Douglas, the Bishop of Carlisle. Well, that's where it rested until 1821. Here are some of the kind of questions that we could ask as we explore the Purgate Price and what's represented to be the Book of Enoch. Could Joseph Smith have copied that material, called it a revelation? If so, we'd have to demonstrate that there were copies of the Book of Enoch containing the material that he incorporated into what he called his two visions of 1830 in June and December. It would seem that certainly there were three books of Enoch available, or at least materials so designated, as early as 1773. In 1821, a year after the first vision, Lawrence issued his first translation of what there were many editions, culminating in the revised edition of 1883. Compiled from notes in his estate. As a former professor of Hebrew at Oxford, Lawrence's familiarity with the Kabbalah and the Zohar, which are Jewish texts and writings, gave him unique qualification. The very profound and encyclopedic work, Comparative Religion and Hermetic Philosophy by Blavatsky, refers to his edition on 37 occasions. This, in my hand, is the translation by Lawrence of one of the books of Enoch brought back by Bruce in 1773, published in 1821, and then revised and issued in 1883. This is a 1976 edition. Could Joseph Smith had it available? Well, it's possible. We don't know of any copies, however, of the 1821 and 1828 publication of Lawrence's translation being in America. It was circulated in Europe to a limited extent. But even if it had been available, could Joseph Smith have copied from it what was in the visions received in 1830? He might have been able to get a little information from it, all right, had he had it available, but he went beyond this particular text. And even what we have in the Pergate Prices is represented as being fragments, extracts from the Book of Enoch, this great book that Enoch had prepared and had been handed on down. So that wouldn't have been sufficient. So then we have to kind of explore some other possibilities. There were a number of other discoveries of the Book of Enoch as time went on. Let's talk about the earlier versions of the Book of Enoch. The ancient translations of the works attributed to Enoch have not yet received sufficient attention wherever they were found. Neither are there any lists of quotations from the Book of Enoch in early Christian literature. Like I mentioned, there's 127 references in the New Testament alone. Now, the version that was brought back by Lawrence is considered the Ethiopian version, the Ethiopic Book of Enoch, a new edition in the light of fragments found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, has just been published by Nib. It's called the Ethiopic Book of Enoch. So Lawrence's early translation and the one by Nib now would comprise the Ethiopic or the Abyssinian version of the Book of Enoch. It wasn't until 1851, the prophet was dead 7 years, when a man by the name of Dillman had been able to accumulate 5 manuscripts of the Ethiopic tradition of Enoch. But it wasn't until 1893 that Charles, R.H. Charles, had assembled these and other manuscripts, now adding up to 10, to prepare an edition on the Ethiopic version. And finally, by the turn of the century, there were 26 manuscripts of the Ethiopic version of the Book of Enoch. These were then prepared in 1906 by Charles in an edition utilizing 23. And then he made a translation and issued an edition called the Book of Enoch, where he utilized 29 manuscripts of the Ethiopic version of the Book of Enoch. This big, thick red book is that publication by Charles, 1912. Could Joseph Smith gotten any of that and copied it? No, he had been dead too long. But there's material in these editions of the Book of Enoch that we find in the Purgate Price. Where did Joseph Smith then get it? Today, it's quite evident that in Abyssinian monasteries, there are probably additional copies of the Book of Enoch, or earlier versions from which the Ethiopic version was copied. This particular text now, the Book of Enoch, utilizes what they believe to be the most complete version, and then collates all the other versions together. So it becomes one of the master texts of the Book of Enoch. But we keep talking about the Book of Enoch. Are we talking about one book or what? Doctrine and Covenants says that that portion of that great vision that took place at the time of the death of Adam, or 3 years before his death, that particular material written in the Book of Enoch will be testified of in due time. So here we get a little understanding that the Book of Enoch compiles or comprises a whole series of things that Enoch added to it. One of which is the account of the activity where Christ appeared at Adam on the Almond 3 years before the death of Adam. And the things concerning what Adam predicted clear down to the latest generations. That was written in the Book of Enoch, among other things. So from the Doctrine and Covenants, we would conclude that the Book of Enoch is a very comprehensive text, partly made up of many books. Well, that does materialize as we find other discoveries being made of the books of Enoch. One of them is the Greek version. In 1886 and 87, digging in the Coptic cemetery in Akamim, Panopolis, in Upper Egypt, a man by the name of S. Grabah found a text called the Greek version, or today we call it the Codex Panoplatinius, since it was found near Panopolis. And then another one called the Chirocodes, which also contained part of the Gospel of Peter, Apocalypse of Peter, and the Acts of St. Julian. The binding of this ancient text is later than the copy of the Enoch material, independent of the New Testament Apocrypha. The Greek versions began to multiply. They found that there had been an earlier one by Cincilius, which contained extracts from this Greek version. We find that in the discovery made in Egypt, that part of the quotation made in Jude is contained in this Greek discovery. In the Epistle of Jude, 4th and 15th, comes out of Enoch 1 and 9 of the Greek version. There were other discoveries made in the Akamim of Egypt and in Oxyrhynchus. Oxyrhynchus was an area in the northern part of the Nile where a monastery had existed with 10,000 monks and 12,000 nuns. They found many fragments, many teachings of Jesus Christ, a lost gospel of Jesus Christ published in 1933 by the British Museum. But in 1930, Chester Beatty was able to acquire for the University of Michigan a series of papyrus materials coming from the 4th century, around 350 A.D., which contained part of the epistles of Enoch. These were in Greek, and so these added to then what was already beginning to accumulate. There was the material of George Cincilius and the Chronicles of Ananus and Pandorus, 5th century material. Two Alexandrian scholars had assembled the Book of Giants, the Book of Dreams, and the Epistle of Enoch. So we were finding that the Greek versions represented at least four books of Enoch. Perhaps they had all at one time been in an original work. Then what about Latin, Coptic, and Syriac translations? There was a man by the name of Tertullius, around the year 220. He was one of the most assiduous readers of the works of Enoch. So prior to his time, the works of Enoch had been assembled, and he was quite a compiler and a student of early Christian materials, and refers abundantly to the works of Enoch. But there's no irrefutable evidence that there was ever in existence a Latin version. However, the Italian mission from Florence in the northern cemeteries of Antonia in 1937 found fragments of the Book of Enoch in Coptic, which is a form of Egyptian writing. So that there was some Coptic discoveries made in Egypt, which is attributed to this material of Enoch. But we have no traces of any special version of the works of Enoch in Syriac literature. And so this brings us down then to just about what we have in terms of the material at the turn of the century. But then there was some medieval material, a Slavonic version of Enoch. Its exact background and source is described in what is today called 3 Enoch, the Hebrew Book of Enoch. Discovered in Russia, in the Caucasus, there was 2 versions, translated around 1876 and on, made available in several different sources. And one of these particular materials were finally made available in translation into English in 1973, first printed in 1928, the 3rd Book of Enoch. Now, the Ethiopic is called the first, and this is the 3rd, so we're kind of looking around then for what we might call the 2nd. There was a book called The Vision of Enoch, which now today is called the 2nd Book of Enoch. In this huge book here by Charles, there's some background on the 2nd Book of Enoch. This book goes back to 1912. The Book of the Secrets of Enoch has, he says, so far as is yet known, been preserved only in the Slavonic version. There was a new version, or a fragment of the Enoch material, found in Russia and in Serbia. Second Enoch, in its present form, was written somewhere about the beginning of the Christian era. Its final editor apparently composed it in Egypt, or copied it. Written at such a late date in Egypt, it was not expected that it should exercise a direct influence on the writers of the New Testament. On the other hand, it occasionally exhibits striking parallelisms in diction and thought. He says, although the very knowledge that such a book ever existed was lost for probably 1,200 years, it nevertheless was made use of by Christians and heretics in the early centuries. But it was not only on Christian literature that the influence of 2nd Enoch is manifest. A Hebrew book entitled The Book of Enoch and twice The Book of the Secrets of Enoch and the Zohar exhibits very close affinities with 2nd Enoch. And so this 3rd Enoch and 2nd Enoch have many parallels. There's correspondence in many areas. Now he has a little bit of information also in terms of the authorship and the background of 3rd Enoch. He believes, says Dr. Charles, that 2nd Enoch in its present form was copied around the year 30 to 70 A.D. It may have actually have been in circulation 30 B.C., for it makes use of certain other books that were available when the temple was still standing. He tries to identify 2nd Enoch as belonging to an author who lived in Alexandria, Egypt. He points out that some of the expressions in there concerning all the souls of men were created before the foundation of the world has rather interesting implications. Man's soul was created originally good, and while in the garden, he could see the angels in heaven. And all of a sudden, you start seeing implications to Mormon doctrine, for no Christian church in 1830 taught any such thing. And yet you'll find these doctrines in the Purgate Price, in the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham, and in some of the other standard works. The righteous will escape the last judgment and will be gathered in eternal life, and they will have no labor, nor sickness, nor sorrow, nor anxiety, nor need, and an incorruptible paradise shall be their protection and their eternal habitation. As for the sinners, hell is preferred for them as an eternal inheritance as well. And in light of what's been said here recently in conference by President Kimball, there's an observation in one of the books of Enoch here, 2nd Enoch, that men will be especially punished for ill treatment of animals. They'll be held accountable. So that's kind of interesting there. The 3rd Enoch is the works of a man by the name of R. Ishmael, who seems to have been able to ascend through 6 heavens and is received by Metronon. And Enoch is given entrance into a 7th. Enoch tells him how he was translated. Enoch tells this individual about his translation. This Jewish work, this 3rd book of Enoch, was published by Jelinek under the title of 3rd Enoch at Lemberg in 1864 and Warsaw in 1876. This is one of those versions that have been found in Russia. Again, says Dr. Charles, we find a large amount of the material has been borrowed from 2nd and the Enoch. Particularly, one part which deals and tells of Moses' ascent to heaven after Metronon had transformed his body into a fiery figure like that of the angels. Now, where did we ever understand that Moses had been translated? It's a Book of Mormon doctrine, a Doctrine and Covenants doctrine. That gives you just a little bit of background concerning the versions and the material that's come down to us in the form of the books of Enoch. Now, maybe we should just give you a little bit additional information there so you can understand. The first book of Enoch, or the Ethiopic, found in 1773, now comprises 29 versions and been collated. The second book of Enoch has a number of versions, and it is published. It's called The Secrets of Enoch, Secret Book of Enoch. The third one is the Hebrew Slavonic Discovery. But Joseph Smith had none of those available, and all of them put together still don't add up to all the content or provide full summary of what we find in the Purgate Price, in the books of Moses. In 1945, another discovery was made. In among the Dead Sea Scrolls in Cave 4, a whole series of fragments of 8 books of Enoch were found. A man by the name of Malik was given the assignment to translate this Aramaic material. This was in Aramaic. It preceded the time of Christ, and therefore could not have been tampered with by Christian hands. So this great, big, huge red book that I have here is called The Books of Enoch by Dr. Malik. For 12 years, he deliberately suppressed the contents of the Books of Enoch. For 27 years, he had the fragments and manuscripts in his possession. Some of the materials of Cave 4 were found in 1952. The publication of the Book of Enoch was made available just barely a year ago. One of the reasons he suppressed it And this is speculation on the part of some of us who are LDS scholars, is because I think he knew that we would get some mileage out of it. Dr. Nibley took him to issue. And some of you may have copies of Dr. Nibley's works on the Books of Enoch that was appearing in the Ensign. Began in about October, 3 years ago, A Strange Thing in the Land, The Return of the Book of Enoch. Have any of you read that? Primarily, these were 13 serialized articles by Dr. Hugh Nibley. In there, he tells about the suppression made of the books and his criticism of Malick. And I guess under pressure, finally, Malick was brought to a point where he published his material. If he was concerned that LDS people might get a lot of mileage out of it, he shouldn't have been, because most LDS people don't read very much anymore. And so it really wasn't all that disturbing. But Dr. Nibley points out how the shock of recognition when he got his copy of Malick's text, because when a scholar is given certain materials to translate, no one else has access to them, and they can keep them for an indefinite period of time. They're actually trying to do something now about that. But he recognized in Malick's material many interesting parallels to the Book of Enoch that Joseph Smith had provided us in the revelations given in 1830, particularly names like Mahijah. This was really a shock. Dr. Nibley commented upon it in his 13th article and is going to prepare an enlarged study of the same thing. I won't be saying anything that will have already appeared in the work of Dr. Nibley. We want to deal with entirely additional material and new material. So now we have all of this material on the stand here, probably about 14 inches thick, dealing with the Books of Enoch. If Joseph Smith had had all this available, he could have pretty well constructed what we find in the Purgate Price. But Joseph Smith went even further than that. He went beyond that. In addition to the confirmation, Joseph Smith gave us specific insights into the atonement, tremendous discussions of the work and reality of Christ's activity and his role in that great dispensation at the time of Enoch and prior to that. So let's see what the content of some of these books of Enoch might have that could possibly show that the restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is authentic. Might confirm in some parts, and also in studying the Book of Enoch, make you aware of the fact that perhaps one of the reasons it was not preserved for the 1700 years before the restoration took place is because in the 3rd and 4th century, the adversary clearly was able to eliminate those beautiful and succinct areas of the gospel. One of the areas that people would recognize most quickly has to do with the Spirit. Because their Mormon doctrine is very unique. 725 Christian churches do not believe in the preexistence of man, preexistence of spirits, the council in heaven, the family in heaven, and things of that kind. Let's see then if there's something in the concepts concerning the spirit and the soul and the fate of the spirit after death and its preexistence in the books of Enoch that might confirm some Mormon doctrine. Now, of course, Mormon doctrine cannot be proven by any of this material. The parallels are there, of course. The proof of everything still resides in the independent testimony that we get from the Holy Ghost. But these are interesting. This scholar, in his translation and commentary, says the term nesama will best be rendered spirit. He says the nesama, or spirit, is indestructible and eternal. In chapter 43 of 3rd Enoch, we read the spirit, even when not united to a body, has a bodily form. This bodily form is evidently, he says, the author is pictured as similar to the form of the physical body. This bodily form must not be confused with the preexistent form preserved in the chambers of creation, with which the spirit is invested when about to go down into life earthly. The spirit is, in all probability, conceived of as preexistent. He goes on and says, this seems to be presupposed by an expression found in chapter 43, speaking of the spirits that have been created and have returned, and the spirits that have not yet been created as two distinct classes. On the supposition that the preexistence of the spirit is taught in our book, says this author, it also follows that the spirits being created means its entering into its manifested existence, creating meaning to be invested with a body, or perhaps rather with a manifested body which determines the growth and appearance of the actual physical body. Further on the same supposition, this author continues, it follows that the character of the spirit is determined by the way in which it fulfills the tasks set for it in its manifested existence. The nesama in its pre-existent state is pure or righteous. Through life earthly, the spirit may become defiled or wholly corrupted. I don't think you'd have to change one word of that. It's pure and simple Mormon doctrine. It violates all the sensibilities of the Christian world. He goes on, the pre-existent spirits have their abode in the presence of the throne of glory. That's where they should be. Now, what is the state of spirits after death? From the 43 to 47th chapter of 3rd Enoch, these things are distilled by this translator in his commentary. Immediately after death, the spirit of man is judged, and according to its life on earth, it is registered among one of the three classes of righteous, intermediate, or wicked. And I think the Book of Mormon pretty well identifies that in 76 section of the Doctrine and Covenants pretty well. The righteous forthwith return to their original abode in the presence of the throne of glory. In other contexts, it is stated that the righteous in the time to come after the second judgment will inherit the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life. To Sheol, in order to go through a process of purification. Now, when purified and wholly cleansed from the defilement caused by their sin, they are most probably regarded as sharing the lot of the righteous. Again, this is all pure and simple Mormon doctrine. But what about the wicked? Well, they are conducted to Gehinnom to be punished in fire. Then he says the intermediate form the large majority. Now, back again there, the intermediate may, by virtue of what they do, be able to inherit the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life in the spirit world. He goes on and says in chapter 47 of the third book of Enoch, the underlying idea seems to be that angels and men are essentially the same kind, only with different spheres of existence and duties. In contrast to the sections treating of the human spirit chapter, 47 uses both Nusama and Ruah, although evidently quite synonymously. Just as the spirits of the righteous return to their Creator after earthly life, he continues, so the spirits and the souls of the angels are said to return to their Creator after the destruction of their perishable body or part. Moreover, the parallelism implies that the spirits and souls of the angels are pre-existent. The spirits of the angels have bodily form as the spirits of men. Would we have to clarify it any further than that? It's literally a comment upon Mormon doctrine right there. Chapter 47 goes on to say, evidently, it is later than the rest of the section within which it appears. And also, there are representations of the transformation of a human being into an angel or a celestial being. In the symbolic language of the earlier mystical literature, there is a garment of glory or a garment of light, and it represents the higher celestial, angelical, spiritual nature. The garment of glory in the writings of 3rd Enoch is attributed as well to angels as to the righteous spirits ascending into heaven. And the difference between men and angels in such connections is only one of degree of perfection. Beautiful material. So the idea of preexistence was known, says this author, to Jewish circles earlier than these documents. Josephus gives it as one of the tenets of the Essenes, who themselves may have been the heirs to the community of Qumran among the Dead Sea Scrolls, who talk about preexistence. It is maintained by prominent scholars that it can be traced even in the pseudepigrapha, and so tape number 97 deals with much of that material in the new great discoveries of the pseudepigrapha, which now comprise over 100 books, most of them made available in the last 7 years. Now, among the books of Enoch, there are a series of insertions. They go like this. In dealing with the divine court, in one of the chapters in 3rd Enoch, there is a section called the Books of the Living and the books of the dead, and the books of records, and the books of judgment. Book, in which are recorded all the doings of the world, and the books of records. I think that a perusal of the Doctrine and Covenants and other salient doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ, nearly every one of those are referred to at one time or another. In fact, you're constantly writing your own book, and an angel is silent, no taking. And sooner or later, you're going to be judged by what is written in the books. And that pretty well is explained there. Now let's make a little departure. Let's go to another area. This is found in the prayer of price. Again in Moses 7, which is the second portion of the vision given to Joseph Smith concerning Enoch. There Enoch observes that the earth can speak and literally weeps under the anguish of what is happening on earth and what is happening to Christ at a certain period of time. And here's what it says in the first book of Enoch. The conscious existence of the sun, moon, and stars. A conscious existence? And also in another part of 1st Enoch, it refers to the preexistence of the Son of Man in the same sense that we understand and know him in the Pearl Gate Price. 3rd Enoch also refers to the preexistence of Enoch and may refer to this same cross-reference into 1st Enoch. There's also the spirits of the elemental forces. Do you mean that all matter has spirit? So says a Mormon doctrine. And then here's an expression, and the righteous and elect shall have been clothed with garments of glory. These shall be the garments of life from the Lord of Spirits. No evil power could get power over men until they had learned the secrets and sorceries from the fallen angels, and through the practice of these had been led astray into idolatry. Is this familiar to you? And they were kept up by the power of the devil to administer these oaths unto the people, to keep them in darkness, to help such as sought power to gain power, and to murder and to plunder and to lie and to commit all manner of wickedness and whoredoms. Now in 1st Enoch it says, no evil could get power over men until they had learnt the secrets and sorceries from the fallen angels, and through the practice of these had been led astray into idolatry. The first quote I gave you was from the Book of Ether in the Book of Mormon. Second from 1st Enoch. There's also parallels in Nag Hammadi and in other places. In the Doctrine and Covenants section 77, verse 1 and 130, verse 7, is there any parallels to what this says? He translated my spirit into the heaven of heavens, and I saw there, as it were, a structure built of crystal. What about the Urim and Thummim? The stone, which gives you knowledge of higher worlds in those sections. Every sin is every day recorded in heaven in the presence of the Most High. In heaven, the angels remember you for good before the glory of the Great One. Am I reading from a Doctrine and Covenants or a Mormon doctrine or a Book of Enoch? You really couldn't tell, could you? It's from the first Enoch. What about three sources of knowledge of celestial things? How do you get knowledge of celestial things? From visions, the words of an angel, and from the books. Is that Mormon doctrine? Or am I quoting from a Book of Enoch? That's from 3rd Enoch. The heavenly tablets and the book of all the deeds of mankind and the heavenly tables record all the deeds of men to the remotest generation, and the 70 shepherds, the angelic rulers, and the representatives of the nations. You mean a council of 70 existed in one of the books of Enoch? Why not? The organization we have today is restored. Enoch initiated first by the Prince of Wisdom and Understanding, then was initiated by the Holy One himself in the secrets of creation. Enoch was specified as being a knower of secrets. In the secrets of creation, what's he being initiated into? Enoch was transformed into a celestial being. His flesh is changed into fire. He is clad in the garments of glory. Well, this is the ultimate destination of all translated beings. Enoch fetched from on earth, sent by the Holy One. Enoch's elevation is final. And when he descends into terrestrial regions, he does so as a celestial being. Violating any Mormon doctrine there at all? No. It does Christian doctrine, because they don't know what it's about. They have no idea what that's saying. The giver of light comes to give his brightness to the whole world. That's in 2nd Enoch. And here again in 2 Enoch, Enoch writes down the secrets revealed to him in the books. See, books of his own, like it says in the Doctrine and Covenants 107 section. And the contents he reveals to men. Obeying a divine command, Enoch reveals the books to his sons and to the men of his generation in order that they may hand them over to the next generation and so on. And we get the same information in our Mormon doctrine. That books were kept, a book of remembrance. In fact, the Perfect Price says there's a book of Adam, a book of Enoch, a book of Noah, a book of Moses, a book of Abraham, all the way down through. At least 10 different books are identified, and they were handed on down. It is particularly incumbent upon each generation or each group of men to whom the books of Enoch have been handed down, that they in turn communicate them. This is to continue till the end time. Confirming your section of the Doctrine and Covenants where it says, and these books will be testified of in due time, and then we've been given an extract of the books of Enoch that even tell about the baptism of Adam and things of that kind. Now there have been many books from the beginning of creation and shall be to the end of the world, but none shall make these things known to you like my writings, said Enoch. And you just read what is contained in chapter 6 to the end of the book of Moses. Doctrine so sublime of the atonement, the preexistence, that hardly can any man contain himself in the tremendous serenity that you find there. None shall make these things known to you like my writings. And right from the very beginning of the restoration of the church, we had the extracts from the book of Enoch. In our time, in our generation. Over here again, and that was from 2 Enoch. There are judgments. Whole sections in 2 and 3 Enoch have to do with judgments. It's called the divine judgment. There are two judgments. They're different. One is called the preliminary judgment. There's also a discussion of the rebelling angels. Now, where would you think that might come from? The preliminary judgment of man is a daily judgment. Angels over all souls of men who write down all their works and their lives before the face of the Lord. Well, again, there's Mormon doctrine again. The righteous or just who are kept in paradise in the third heaven until the final judgment, after which they are to be gathered together for the life in the new age, this world being perished. Their dwelling place will be a new paradise, the great paradise. To the former, the place of torture is situated in the third heaven. I mean, there's a place in the called the third heaven where there might be anguish, gnashing of teeth, and suffering. Read the 76th Second Doctrine and Covenants. For the wicked from the first judgment, the final judgment making no change in the fate of the wicked. It goes on and talks about hell, situated below the heavens, probably under the earth. Their punishment begins immediately after death, but they await the final decisions after their punishment to be given at the final judgment. In 3rd Enoch, it talks about the large majority of men are neither perfectly righteous, but not wholly wicked. And in the 76th section of Doctrine and Covenants, the terrestrial beings will be quite content, quite happy. Enoch speaks of three classes of men. Righteous. Their spirits have their abode in the presence of the throne of glory. In the time to come, the righteous shall inherit the Garden of Eden. The perfectly wicked are punished. The intermediate, who have to go through a sort of purgatory until they are cleansed from their sins. After being purified, some may probably be accounted as righteous. Again, I'm quoting from 3rd Enoch. So the parallels are quite interesting. Now let's go to a little entirely different aspect of the books of Enoch that have a little different material. Some people might be scientists, and they may want to see if there's anything in these materials that have fragments or related to that material. And I've lost a little tab here, but we'll see if we can find it real quick. No one born on the earth can hide himself, nor can his deeds be concealed. It is particularly incumbent upon each generation or each group of men to whom the books of Enoch have been handed down to communicate them on. There's one area here in the books of Enoch that deals with the elemental aspects of material. It talks about 60 elements, the very first of which is the structural element upon which all things are built. And then it says there are 32 others, a total of 92 structural blocks upon which the material aspect of the universe is constructed. Are any of you chemists? There's 92 elements in the periodic table. And the very first one is a gas, hydrogen. in the book of Enoch, it talks about this very first one is the one upon which all others are generated. And the bulk of the creation of the universe is made out of it. Are you familiar with astronomy, any of you? 98% to 99% of the volume of the universe is hydrogen. So if you want to pursue, what was Enoch doing with this kind of knowledge in the years before Christ, before there was even science of chemistry ever developed? And yet you look up the Fergate Price, the book of Enoch, book of Abraham, and they were thoroughly familiar with all that was going on. Let's go to another material, the books of Enoch here by Malick. There's one area of interest that confirms another part of our Mormon doctrine. And to Raphael, the Lord said, "Do go, Raphael, and bind Azazel, hand and foot, and cast him into darkness." It's only in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 128, that we get any information on Raphael. Tape number 91 tries to provide that information from the book of Enoch that was provided here. Then there's another area that's kind of interesting. And this has to do within the portion of the Fergate Price that dealt with the name Mahijah. I'm looking now at what they call 4Q Enoch. It's a reconstruction of a number of fragments. And there's a reference here to Mahijah, a man by that name. Mahiway, there's a difference in the consonant, very little difference, and in the vowels, not too much. But there's one, two, three, or four references here to this person who inquires of Enoch. And this is the one that gave the shock of recognition to Dr. Nibley when he got into the first copy of the Enoch, the Book of Giants. And where does it discuss giants? You'll find that in the Fergate Price, in the Book of Moses, in the extracts from the Book of Enoch about the giants who are upon the face of the earth. There's even a geographical area in the Fergate Price dealing with Mahijah, and very likely, perhaps, we might find some more materials on the Book of Enoch that will confirm that portion of the Fergate Price. We certainly have the name and the individual who often made inquiries of Enoch. He may have been a little skeptic individual. We find also that the Book of Enoch now is being discovered in the Manichaean discoveries of Turfan, China, and also in the Cave of 1,000 Buddhas. And there's two tapes, an hour each, on those two discoveries. These elements, drawn from the Manichaean Book of Giants and known essentially through the manuscript discovered in Turfan and Chotsko, are amply sufficient to identify correctly an Aramaic fragment coming from Cave 6 of Qumran, published in 1962. And here again we find the name Mahijah and its equivalent that's found in the Fergate Price. We can range therefore very far in terms of identifying the sources and the use to which the Book of Enoch was put. It was utilized in China until the 14th century, when the church begins its missionary work in China, particularly in western China, in the area of Turfan, in the Lop Nor Desert. They'll be able to find that there are many Chinese there who are quite informed about much that's today Mormon doctrine, and conversions may be made, I would predict, quite easily in that sector of China. Now, I think there's a few other little references here that might be of interest. The function of Enoch as his role as a sign of knowledge for all generations was to be formulated by the author of the Book of Jubilees, which is another Dead Sea Scroll, because he was sent down to the earth as the sign that he might witness against all the children of men and foretell every work of the generations until the day of judgment. Remember what he inserted in the 107th section of the Doctrine and Covenants? Adam's prediction of everything down to the last generation. For the work of Enoch was created as a testimony for the generations of the world, in which he recounted to all generations their action up to the day of judgment. But one of the great things that are materializing here from the books of Enoch is an astronomical book, a whole series of astronomical aspects. These are going to be the subject of a future study. It's rather exciting. You'd have to have a fundamental knowledge of the books of Enoch and the fourth chapter of Abraham, and then the information contained in the Fergate Price, because Enoch is referred to as making statements such as that there are worlds, millions of worlds like this one. Where was the concepts of worlds innumerable and the vast immensity of space and that delirium of immensity that's out there? Galaxies and infinite galaxies, creations stretching into infinite space. Well, it was all here in the pretty much in outline in the books of Enoch. I'm going through Malick's material here now because it talks about the sun and the moon and the starry heavens and deals with presiding stars. Now, where was there any such a mention made that there was a presiding star? Here's what it says. The passage in Sincilius on the role of the angel Kokab, star of God. Familiar to any of you? We know it as Kolob, but all you'd have to do is change one small little insertion there to know what it's all about. A presiding star that close? Where did Joseph Smith get it? This seems to refer, no doubt, to the final part of the astronomical document which described the movement of the stars. You find this in the book of Abraham, how the medium which transpires through the misty of space is that by which Kolob controls worlds of this order. A clear reference to the last section of the astronomical book of Enoch, which lists many names of angels and presiding stars. It's only in the Egyptian grammar book that Joseph Smith refers that there are 12 presiding stars. Seasons and days probably continue to the end of the book. The fact that there's a conscious existence of all matter, including the earth. Then there's another book called the Book of Watchers. The first copy, bound in Cave 4, dates from the first half of the 2nd century before Christ. It was therefore like the second copy of Enoch, brought to the Qumran from elsewhere. It seemed to have been copied in the scriptorium of Qumran in the course of the 1st century A.D., formed part of the great Enoch collection. Watchers? Because here now we find there those who are set at the gates to ask you certain things. The Book of Watchers has essentially the same form as that which is known through the Greek and Ethiopic versions. There's other parallels. It describes the place of abode on one hand of God, and the blessed on the other hand of sinners, the wicked angels, and the stars. The Book of Watchers is rather fascinating and interesting and could be the subject of an entire tape. He tells also in this part of the Book of Watchers about the chiefs of the fallen angels. The angels of the Lord come down to the earth to instruct the children of men and to bring about justice and equity on the earth. Wasn't there an angel that came to Adam and Eve and instructed them? What about the adversary himself? There's a whole discussion of the fallen angels in Enoch 18 and 19 in the Book of Watchers and the erring stars. There's also a discussion of the missions of Enoch, his descent from paradise and his ascent to the celestial palace and some of his activities before the Most High, the Lord of Lords, Masters of Eternity. We're told in the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith that the work of Enoch is among terrestrial spheres, that he's a teacher. In one of the portions of the Book of Watchers, it tells about this paradise is thus situated exactly in the northeast of the universe. It contains the tree of knowledge. This aspect of distance and times and universe materializes out of these great books. And then there's a place called the Great River, as far as the great darkness, there where no being of flesh may go. What are we told about where the adversary will go? We're told it's so bad that no one knows. Joseph Smith saw it a little while and then it was shut up and he couldn't remember any of it. He says only those who are going to go there are going to experience it. Then there's the Book of Dreams and the Epistle of Enoch. So here we are in the paradise of the precious mountain, which constitutes the third and highest celestial sphere. You mean there's three divisions in the celestial kingdom? Subject of an actual revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants. The second dream presents a tableau of world history from the creation of the first man to the advent of the kingdom of God. Individuals and people appear in this. They're clad in animal skins, whilst the angels are transformed into men dressed in white. There are three white men representing angels, referred to in one part of the Book of Dreams. In the Nag Hammadi, it talks about these were companions to Adam. In the Epistle of Enoch, according to the Michigan Papyri, which seems to be where we get the information concerning that the adversary wanted the body of Moses. And this is where we find in the pseudepigraphal work on the Testament of Moses that the adversary, just before Moses would be translated, wanted him dead. Michael detected the adversary and thwarted his purpose. In that episode, you'll find similarly in the 128th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. It tells about Noah. In 7 years, Noah learned the three books of creation and the books of signs and the book of wars. And if I were to read to you from the book of Noah, which is part of the book of Enoch, you'd find many parallels there that deal with our present understanding of some aspects of Noah found in the Brugget Price. I think that you've gotten a pretty good taste of some of the material found here in the books of Enoch and what they might provide for the world at large. But here's one I think that's a little unusual. This is kind of interesting because it says that there was an Enoch. Enoch was sent down and taught men unholy mysteries. Now, how could you understand that? In the Purgate Price, we find that Cain had a son called Enoch and taught men the mysteries of the master of Mahan. So the Purgate Price distinguishes between the righteous Enoch, who is a descendant of Methuselah, and an unrighteous Enoch, who the adversary used, and he was called a minister, to teach men unholy mysteries. Malik has it developed pretty thoroughly in here. There are now studies that are being prepared. For example, structure of Enoch tradition in the New Testament. We mentioned the many references. But how about this? A whole study on the rebellion in heaven. For the books of Enoch deal with the rebellion in heaven. And again, it's the Purgate Price, which gives us most of the information concerning the council in heaven and the adversary's role and the choice of the Redeemer, Jesus Christ, in opposition to the individual who first proclaimed, "Father, send me, I shall go down. Not one of your children will be lost." Well, there's implications in those, both of those directions in the books of Enoch. We've pretty well given you an outline of the material of Enoch. There's maybe just a few other passages that might be of interest in the few minutes that we have remaining. From 1851 until the turn of the century, there were 50 men who worked on the books of Enoch. What a little good it did them in terms of their work. In one of them, it was brought out, "These are they who raise their hands against the Most High and cast down the stars of heaven and tread them upon the earth." Now, who taught that the adversary raised his hands against the Most High and that the stars of heaven were cast down and were cast to earth? The Mormon parallel there is apparent. "I saw these very sheep burning, the first among them being the Lamb." And there's a whole discussion here concerning the Son of Man, preexistence of Jesus Christ. The book of Enoch, then, is still not yet testified of. All we have are fragments and extracts. The Purgate Price represents itself as being extracts from the book of Enoch. But the very fact that Joseph Smith restored to us in 1830 these beautiful, succinct doctrines, and now discoveries have been made that confirm many of them, just point out again that the restoration is confirmed by discoveries being made since the time of Joseph Smith, mostly by non-Mormons, their translations, their commentaries, all plain and simple. We're looking forward to the full and complete book of Enoch and its restoration. Of all we have part, we can testify to the world Joseph Smith was a prophet. Revelation was received, and may we all get a testimony of that. In Christ's name, amen.